portfolio in the timber business, just to get an idea of what kind of experience we might expect?
I think that they're out of that, the bank examiner's audit, when they get through over there, should be available. I don't know when it's coming back, Paul, do you know where? So it should be out shortly, but.
Next 2-3 hours.
Probably not in the next hour or two. But I tell you, there isn't going to be any fresh seafood left in about a half an hour either, but.
That's right.
The, I have a private supply for a few of you left.
Tabling motion, is that what I heard?
The, the answer with ARC, I don't know if you want to get into that. ARC was set up as an equity investment vehicle, and I'm not sure it didn't work properly as it was, but it didn't sustain its political support to ever see whether it would have been a success or not.
Mr. Chairman, might I just add a point to that? You know, a lot of these loan programs aren't, that we're talking about are loan programs that are available for general purposes. What we've tried to do here is come up with a very focused program with a very specific goal in mind, and that is to get the equipment to get us into the markets that have been identified as necessary to do our goals, namely to improve the health down here and establish the industry up in the interior and South Central. You know, so we've crafted the language of this program, so that is the objectives that will be achieved if the program goes. It's not a general loan program, so I don't think you can really make a comparison in the history of the loan failures in a direct loan program for general purposes to a loan guarantee program targeted to do a very specific chore. And that's really what we're trying to do here.
Well, what I was trying to do is I was trying to see what the history was with the private banks, and we don't have any private bankers here. I said Dick Hall was on the phone, but I don't think we've got anything from NBA, who apparently does do some loans here in Southeast.
NBA is a substantial lender in the timber business in Southeast.
So the history or the experience we get to look at would be NBA, and they aren't here, CFAB, ARC, and then the other question that came up would probably be good to have a state forester here to talk about what kind of cruisers he'd need in order to identify the timber that would be needed to, you know, guarantee some sort of supply.
Well, we had that in the subcommittee.
The state forester?
Well, it's John Sturkin.
Did he testify?
He's a constituent of mine, good man.
I was covering that portion of the day.
Oh, in our subcommittee, yeah, but not in the loan. I thought you meant down the loans committee
on
this bill.
And in the subcommittee on the DNR budget.
Oh, yeah, right. That's where I was familiar with the state forester. He was the one that brought up that business about the cruisers. But
Representative Porchot, what was your intent here, to adopt loan CS and then work from that as our document before us? You were the one doing the
Mr. Chairman, my intention
was
for whatever discussion purposes and for the pleasure of the committee would be to adopt the amendment to the Labor and Commerce CS.
The Labor and Commerce CS?
Loans CS for 78.
An extra one.
No, I apologize.
Which one are we talking about?
Loans CS.
Or vice versa, yeah. That we would adopt the loan CS, and then for discussion purposes, I would move this amendment to this. And
okay, why don't we adopt a CS so we have a working document before us?
Well, we might as well in one motion and just strike those sections 31 through 34.
Well, the amendment will
the amendment will be around.
Okay.
We start with that and get the document before us.
Mr. Chairman, I would move and ask unanimous consent that the Finance Committee adopt House CS for CS for Senate Bill 78 loans.
Jack.
Okay, there's objection. All in favor of the adopting the loan CS, and show of hands. 3, 4, 5, 6. Motion carries. Okay, we have the CS before us. Now, you want to propose an amendment?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I hope we haven't boxed ourselves in. I would point out that there is language in this CS, and I would, my intention of adopting the CS was not to adopt the existing language that's in the bill relative to.
I'm assuming adopting the CS, we now have a working document before us, so now you can.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I would
change that and
move and ask unanimous consent that we adopt what I will call amendment number one, which would start out on pages 14 through 16, delete sections 30 through 34 in their entirety and insert this material and renumber accordingly.
Is that a motion?
That's a motion.
Object.
Okay.
Just last motion.
Discussion on the motion.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I guess my concern is by putting this, I had Representative Cotton and Representative Duncan had the opportunity of going through the Loans Committee substitute. I'm aware of what's in the Loans Committee substitute. However, this particular amendment, in all good faith and respect to Representative Pershaw, first of all, has not gone through legal drafting. I realize that they've worked on it jointly. At least that's what he tells me, which I'm sure is correct. And there are some things in here which I think are objectionable. We're getting into road construction. We're changing a number of other things in here. And I would prefer if we had a drafter that could look it over before the Finance Committee puts all this into law. So I'd object to inserting this in. If we're going to work from a working document, we should be working from the Loans Committee document.
Question.
Further discussion on that?
I would just say that I think this was drafted by some lawyers. They may not have been the lawyers over in the courthouse, but they were lawyers. I think they're probably okay.
Representative Pershaw? Mr. Chairman, just to respond, I've known Mr. Clark for a long time and known him to draft things in U.S. law for a long, long time. I'm perfectly comfortable with his drafting. I've reviewed this. I've added a little of my own.
Okay,
Mr.
Chairman, this should draw the body's attention to the fact that we are changing the from the original committee substitute loans committee. We're changing from revenue over to commerce and economic development. Maybe I could get it.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a couple comments. One. Personally, I would prefer the proposed amendment to the original bill, but the original bill is a lot more wide open than the amendment, so I think by the amendment you're tightening up this program and I can, in one sense, make it better. The second aspect that I wanted to comment on is what Representative Ewing brought up, that the original Forest Products Loan Guarantee is in the Department of Revenue under Title 4594020. This proposed amendment, if you'll note, is 4593010. It repeals the existing program and creates it over in the Department of Commerce, which is with the blessing of the Commissioner of Revenue and the Commissioner of Commerce. It's the last loan program, I think, out of Revenue and puts it into Commerce. If we have somebody from Revenue here, if they, I don't know who wants to mention on that, but that's the effect of it. But I would support the amendment, even though it's much more restrictive than the what's in the present CS.
Question.
Further discussion on that? Okay, the motion then would be to adopt Mr. Porcheau's amendment, starting with section 30, correct? All in favor? Show of hands. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Motion fails.
Mr. Chairman, could we have a roll call vote just for the record, please?
Without objection, go ahead and.
Thank you.
You need the cheat sheet. She hasn't quite remembered who we are yet.
She doesn't know her name.
Did you sit out there and read them going, huh?
Representative Frank?
if we don't put this one in there, we're going to have the existing language. Then is that going to be our intention to move that bill out of
No.
Representative
Cotton?
What I'll do is I'll move we report out the CS consent bill number 78 finance. It removes all language that has to do with forest products loans.
Then we, which would be a new
is that
an amendment, would include in that an amendment then would to delete that section.
No, I just wouldn't. I just pass out the Senate bill instead of the. We just remove
the Senate
committee.
Bill.
Yeah, we just move the. I would move that we move from committee to the Senate bill without the loans committee sales through or any of this amended languages.
Chairman, we don't have to have the bill out tonight, but Representative Duncan.
What? As it turns out,
we've got a member over here that tells me he's got a party to go to.
Oh, take Duncan, a couple minutes here, just. Probably stand at ease for a couple
minutes.
Okay, why don't we?
Well, let's get the hell out of here.
Back to order. Department wanted to testify relative to the cash flow or something similar there, too. Hey, is that what you were requesting?
For the record, again, my name is Maggie Hanley. I'm director of the Division of Accounting and Collections in the Department of Commerce and Economic Development. The department has asked me to represent them on their behalf as far as the department's position on this portion of the bill goes. And there are three major concerns that we have that we would want to be complied with. With the permission of the chair, I'd like to address the funding issue, although that's not part of this particular bill.
We're not being part of it, it's awful close. Go ahead.
That's true. One is that the department will support this amendment only if there's no FY86 fiscal impact. Also that if loans are appropriated to fund the Forest Products Loan Guarantee Fund, that they would be taken out of the defunct loan funds, and that there would be a maximum of $25 million in principal that would be taken. This means that the cash flow from those loans would estimate about $3.5 million a year. And the department's position is that the maximum loan guarantees per year would be equal and not exceeding the total amount of cash flow from those loans. So that $25 million would fund about $3.5 million of loan guarantees per year after FY87.
Questions?
Yeah, I wonder if you could break down the outstanding principal balance in the small business loans under 4595 and then the tourism loans under 4590.
Yes, there's approximately $30 million in outstanding principal balances in small business and about $3 million in tourism.
Mr. Chairman, as you've probably heard, we are now hypothetically talking about possibly limiting the total amount of loans, principal of which would not exceed, for guarantee purposes, of $12,500,000. How would that figure then relate to the $33 million of principle of loans that we've been talking about?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Porchot, it would equate, in that the department's position on the bill would be that the language should be written in such a way that only the cash flow from those loans can be used for guarantees, not the principal amount. There isn't any way we can go out and sell those loans. And if we were to use those loans as guarantees themselves, that would be the same as going into debt, which you have to have voter approval for.
Okay, so I'm glad you made that distinction. So that really our question is not so much what is the total value of the unpaid balance in terms of the portfolio. The question is, if you say you're only going to loan $3 to $3.5 million based on, I'm sorry, now is that based on $25 million of those or $33 million of the whole shebang?
It would be 3.5 to 4 based on the $30 million.
Based on the $30 or $33 million. So then, the question I guess then would be, how many years would we want to have open those loans? And I guess to do some real rough math, we'd be talking about three into 12, 4 years worth of cash flow on those to reach our cap or our proposed cap here. Then after that time, the structure, I assume, would be then that we would, whatever we had guaranteed, everything else would drop back into your, I assume you would want us to drop back any unencumbered loans or that additional cash flow or further cash flow wouldn't be necessary from?
Well, the cash flow from these loans currently is transferred into the general fund because they're defunct loan funds. So it would be the pleasure of the legislature as to what would be done with cash flow after the fourth year. If the loans themselves are appropriated to the Forest Products Loan Guarantee Fund, then those loans, their assets and their cash flow until their maturity date would belong to the Forest Products Loan Guarantee Fund. And it would take an action of the legislature to change that.
So the loans would stay there, but we could say after 4 years, all cash flow or all the principal, all the interest and principal payments on those would then revert to the general fund. I mean, we could say something like that. So you're primarily, the pool of money necessary to guarantee is, all that is the sum of the cash of the interest and principal payments annually, is that right?
That's correct.
And so, so the other question then from that we will be facing is how much reduced revenues annually are we willing to do or wanting to do to apply towards these guarantees? Now, 4 years, is that well within the outstanding balance time on these loans?
Mr. Chairman, yes, Representative Porcio.
And yes. Based.
Just transferring the payments.
Well, now this is what I was trying to clarify. If under our proposed amendment, we are limiting the total amount of loans that we're going to guarantee to $12,500,000 or $10 million worth of exposure, then once your pool reaches $10 million, if the entire maximum was obligated, then there would be no further need for any more cash flow. Your $10 million is all you need to guarantee the principal of those loans.
Yes, and if I understand you, then if you do not, I guess, want to state that if you do not transfer that to the general fund, then yes, you're still going to guarantee funds to cover the guarantee. But if you're talking about transferring that for years, then there would be no money left.
I think we're saying the same thing. I'd say the first 4 years of income stream you keep in the fund.
Okay.
Beyond that, everything automatically would fall back, and this would, but then as I understand your testimony, this under your feelings or what you want to do, you would only lend $3 to $3.5 million per year. You wouldn't, even though we might provide for more loans than that, that would be the maximum that you would want to loan off of those.
Mr. Chairman, can I make a question? Clarification. I don't think they're loaning anything. They're just guaranteeing it, right?
Well,
you're just guaranteeing it. So, in other words, whatever goes into the fund is just a guarantee for someone who wants to take it against us.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question on page 2. The first
page 2 of the bill or the amendment?
Of the amendment. In the first paragraph under section 4593040, investment of the fund, the last sentence says, income from investment and interest on loans or monies in the fund shall be transferred to the general fund. Now, that is not clear to me whether that means if these loans are appropriated to the Forest Products Guarantee Revolving Loan Fund, or Guarantee Fund, whether the interest on the loans that we presently have in small business that would be funding this guarantee program would go into the general fund, our cash flow would be substantially reduced from the $3.5 to $4 million a year, because a good share of that is interest. And it's just not clear to me from reading this bill what, when it says interest on loans, whether it means the interest on the guarantees or the interest on the loans that would be appropriated.
I would read that to say the interest on any funds that are not being used. If there's $5 million in the fund and only three of it's being used to guarantee loans, the balance will be invested. The interest made on those investments will go to the general fund. I think that's the way I'm reading that.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Frank?
That's kind of unclear to me as well, and I'd have to admit that I haven't been paying it good attention in the last few minutes here, but it seems to me we're saying that if we appropriate these loans to a fund, that fund will have a cash flow, or those loans will produce a cash flow of $3 or $4 million, which would allow you to guarantee $3 or $4 million per year, and that to appropriate any of those funds out back to the general fund would be inconsistent and really defeat our own purpose. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's partially correct. I think income from the investment on the fund itself does belong in the general fund, otherwise it's a dedicated fund. And to build it in this way creates, to build it in any other way creates problems. But I think that I would agree with Representative Ewing, Mr. Chairman, that before this was enacted, that there does need to be some clarification by an expert on exactly what that means.
Well,
are you an expert?
I'm not next. I agree that I think that needs.
Why don't
to be
we?
Clear.
Yeah. We'll take a look at that section.
Chairman, right now.
Well, can I ask?
Representative Frank.
What would you rely on if the? Okay, you're saying that we have a dedication of funds if we don't let the earnings go back to the general fund. What would we rely on if we? You know, what produces the cash flow? The principal. Or what?
Mr. Chairman, the income from the investment that Treasury makes of the funds is something that goes into the general fund. In the revolving loan funds that we currently administer, the interest and the principal comes back to the revolving loan fund, absent any legislation that would change that. And so currently we would be relying on the interest and the principal on those funds and on those loans coming back into the Forest Product Guarantee Fund, but not the investment in the, you know, the stock market or bonds or whatever on the money itself that's in the fund while it sits there.
Let me see if I can get this right. Okay, let's say that you have a loan there that generates $10,000 worth of interest in a year and $5,000 worth of principal repayment, and as those monies sit in that fund for that year, it also produces roughly $1,500 worth of investment earnings. Mm-hmm. You're saying that the investment earnings must go to the general fund, but the interest and the principal could remain in the in this guarantee fund, if that's what we're calling it, for the satisfaction of guarantees.
Mr. Chairman, I think that is what I'm saying, although I think the AG's office in their opinion on dedicated funds may take exception to that and may feel that the interest itself on the loan should go into the general fund as well. Currently, historically, the interest on the loans themselves come back to the revolving loan funds.
Okay, so, but if I can continue, what we did with Red Dog was we appropriated the assets, the income as well as the principal, not to mention the investment earnings. What's different on this?
Well, you're appropriating it to ADA. In this case, you're appropriating it back to the general fund, and all I was saying is that the cash flow would be much less than $3.5 million per year if you intended to appropriate the interest on the loans that we're holding in Commerce back to the general fund.
Mr. Chairman, maybe that's it in a nutshell. If we're trying to get some sort of cash flow limit, then, and we cut that off at a certain point, in essence, we could structure the thing so that once you reach the $10 million or whatever the level of the guarantee that's necessary, everything else falls back. And I think that's going to achieve the same thing.
Yeah, I don't see much advantage to as long as there isn't a dedication. Seems to me I don't know. The question is, can we dedicate all those funds, all those loans, or I should say, can we appropriate those assets to that fund within the Department of Commerce, call it a loan guarantee fund or whatever, and then repeal our act in 4 years or something, like maybe we could do that or something. Mm-hmm. And so we wouldn't have to mess around with trying to shift some of that, you know, that investment earnings on the principal and interest coming back in to the general fund. I don't know.
We're going to put this back into a subcommittee with Representative Porcheau. Why don't we take a look at that language in there and try and clarify that so we know what we're doing to work with that.
Mr. Chairman, I would feel more comfortable if we could, and with Representative Porcheau's help, if we could just run this by the drafter, and then I could feel more comfortable with the language that was in there between now and
I think you just got a subcommittee member.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
I've worked on this for 3 years.
If you've got a drafter that you can, like, bring up here...
We have dial a drafter. You want to pass the bill out tonight?
No,
tomorrow morning at 8, but...
Well, then they can be here at 7, and we can work on it. Because if it isn't technically right, then we're going to have some problems with it, and it's obviously to the best advantage of people...
Okay, why don't we see if we can work on doing that and see if we can get a drafter in the morning to review it. Representative Sund.
No, that's fine, Mr. Chairman. I think the two issues here, one is Senate Bill 78, the other one is going to go into House Bill 195. So technically it has to be drafted, but I would, the reason I came back up here, revolving interest, investment money, and dedicated revenues are three phrases that get my attention immediately. And if we have a problem with this one, we got a major problem with what we did the other day.
Okay, well, why don't we go ahead and work with this? I think we're narrowing down the problem areas with this. Appreciate the patience and time of everybody to be here this late, but hopefully we won't make you do this for very many more days. That will adjourn.
For those,
did you get me, Representative Larson? We had a quorum here just a minute ago.
You have before you is I'd like you, we're getting the front section of second committee substitute for House Bill number 195 Finance. You know, it's a reappropriation bill. Does anybody have any questions on it or anything? Because I'd like it to go out this morning. And it's on a floor calendar.
What's new?
It's just last section, Sam.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
He who hesitates is lost.
One minute. Okay. We can hold it if you'd like and go to the something else.
I just haven't had a chance to look over the latest version, so I'm quick to do that.
We're going to hold 195 to a little later. Let's go on to Senate Bill number 35. We have before us House Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for Sponsors Substitute for Senate Bill number 35, Resources. This particular bill creates the Neltina Public Use Area, which includes a couple million of acres of land in the Talkeetna's areas. This has zero fiscal note. Is there anybody here that would like to testify on this bill?
I can if there are questions.
Yes, move it.
Thank you.
I had moved report out Senate Bill 35.
Is there any objections? Hearing none, Senate Bill 35 with zero fiscal notes moved to the committee. The next bill we'll take up is House Bill number 243. This particular bill relates to compensation of non-covered state employees. The chair has prepared a finance CS for your consideration. The CS freezes the salaries of legislators, the governors, and the lieutenant governor. It establishes the salary schedule for the non-covered state employees and funds the pay raise for them. The package from the chair also includes a fiscal note that pays 80% of these pay raises in the letter of intent, and the letter of intent approves all state employee pay raises. Representative Duncan.
Mr. Chair, I'd move adoption of the committee substitute, finance committee substitute.
Just this objection. For purpose of objection, several of us have been waiting for a vehicle like this all year to introduce some legislation repealing the legislative pay raise, which we've been trying for. Since this will be on the floor, I'm going to refrain from offering that amendment to this, but just put people on notice that that amendment will be offered on the floor today.
Thank you very Thank much. You. Yes. Your objection removed from the adoption?
Chairman, I'd move a report out to House Bill 2, Committee Substitute, Finance Committee Substitute, House Bill 243, Finance.
Is there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. The next bill we have is Senate Bill 311. Before you is a committee substitute for Senate Bill 311, Finance and Act, increasing the bond authorization for bond revenues and providing for an effective date. This is a Senate version bill that increased the airport revenue bond authorization to $100 million, as we discussed yesterday. Representative Cotton, do you have anything on it?
I'm ready to move it out.
Representative Cotton.
Oh, I think it's a Rieger's got a letter of intent.
Yes, sir.
Has it been passed out to everybody?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I move the letter of intent. Yes, unanimous.
There's objection for so people can see your letter of intent.
Let's get copies passed out.
Okay. It's in our packets.
Yeah. Oh, I've already seen it, but Steve did it.
Excellent piece. What artwork. His letter of intent. Terrific.
Representative Cotton, did you have a chance to read it? Who's reading the letter?
No, I'm fine. Go ahead.
No objection. Okay. Anybody have any problems with the bond?
We report the bill out of the letter of intent.
And the fiscal note? Is there any objections? Hearing none, committee substitute for Senate Bill number 311, Finance, with its letter of intent, and the fiscal note is moved out of committee. The next bill we'll take up is House Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for Senate Bill number 53, Judiciary, an act relating to an exchange of unemployment insurance information providing an effective date. This particular bill is needed because of the change in federal law. It requires labor to give appropriate state and federal agency wage information so their income and eligibility can be verified for various public assistance programs. Alaska Administrative Fund funding that the feds pay for could be withdrawn if this bill doesn't pass, which is over $22 million. Is there anybody that would like to testify on this particular bill?
Mr. Chairman, I'm available to answer any questions.
Yes. Representative Duncan.
I move a report out to House Committee Substitute Judiciary for Senate Bill 53.
Zero fiscal note.
Zero fiscal note.
Is there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Before us
House Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for Senate Bill Number 65, Loans. This particular bill has three parts. One, it changes the name of the Northwest Regional Housing Authority, so the Northwest Alaska Native Association, to the Northwest Alaska Native Association. It removes the Urban Nonconforming Housing Program to HFC from the CRA Housing Assistance Division. That change has been already made in the budget. Third, it changes the definition of rule for the Rural Nonconforming Housing Program that stays in CRA. In addition, the Senate CS added interest on loans repayments to the Rural Nonconforming Housing Loan Fund. This change has been accounted for in the past budget. It has a zero fiscal note. There is a letter of intent from the Senate that attempts to clarify the status of loans from certain groups whose rural status will change after the definition of rural status. There is also a letter of intent prepared by the chairman that attempts to ensure that no Alaskan is left out without eligibility for one of the other non-conform programs. The letters of the intent also address the status of the housing loans to farmers. We have here to explain this is Jeff Smith. Yeah.
Talbot Cove.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The department supports this bill for a number of reasons, and I think the main reason is this bill attempts to reflect the current and projected revenue income that the state is expecting to receive not only in fiscal year 86, but in the out years beyond that. And attempts to provide a mechanism where both Alaska Housing Finance and Community and Regional Affairs will be put in a position to meet the total demand for housing loans. And with the change of the urban nonconforming from DCRA to Alaska Housing Finance, will provide a mechanism whereas HFC can better meet the full demand of that program than we were able to. We project the demand for that program in FY86 at $16 million. Under the most optimistic revenue projections and appropriation levels for the housing assistance, we would be able to meet approximately between 45 and 52% of that demand. With the transfer to Alaska Housing Finance, they will now be in a position to meet the full demand of the $16 million. This will also allow us to take the appropriation level that we do receive for the Housing Loan Fund, apply that to strictly rural programs, and be in a position to meet the full 12-month demand for that program. And as we were preparing the budget based on the new revenue projections, if the program would not change, it looked like that we would run out of funds in the rural program at the end of March or first part of April, thus having no funds to commit for the three critical months in rural Alaska of April, May, and June, where it's important for us to make loan commitments so that materials can be purchased and barge orders can be made to ensure arrival of the materials on site. There are other aspects of the bill we support, and we think that the change in the rural definition is important, but also to ensure that no one is left without service. I think that both the Senate intent and the chairman's recommended House intent adequately provide for that and will force Alaska Housing Finance and DCRA to evaluate the program over the next 6 months. If it is not working the way this bill sets it out to do, we are then required to come in with some recommendations on how what changes are needed to make it work better. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
I'm not an expert on this one by a long shot, but I was looking at the backup material, and there's this thing that talks about list of communities affected by CSSB 65. Is that still a valid list?
Yes, it is.
The couple questions, you know, in the disclaimer up there, it talks about the considers rural those communities with only part-time road maintenance. Cordova's only got part-time road maintenance?
Well, that's probably, and I don't have that document in front of me, but that's not the real driver behind the definition of part-time road maintenance. It's the main driver of the definition is connected to roads, connected by roads, not whether there's full-time maintenance or not.
Well, let's try another one then. Seldovia. That's rural interface? Is Seldovia as an example? Where does it sit into it?
I believe that that...
already was rural.
It always was rural. It still is then?
Yeah.
Okay. But the key there is connection. It's not necessarily maintenance.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Franklin.
Thank you. Jeff, how is Alaska Housing Finance going to finance the non-conforming loans that they aren't able to bond, sell bonds for?
Okay. Our discussions with them, they were going to fund those out of their general fund appropriations and their fund balances that are not bond related. And they felt that they could meet 50% of the demand with bond money. They're also going to put in some incentives in their non-conforming program to encourage, one, if it's new construction, that an effort's made to provide that housing to be conforming, and other avenues in the program so as to decrease the number of non-conforming houses we're constructing in the state.
If I could follow that up, I guess that's an area that is open to some area of discussion, it's not exactly, to me it's not, I'm not sure what's conforming and what's non-conforming. I know there's been some historical disagreement between the real estate community and and your department as to building new non-conforming. I mean, there's a demand, let me put it this way, there's a demand for financing for housing that doesn't conform to FHA standards. But is perfectly livable, and there's a demand for it, I guess is what I'm saying. And I'd hate to see that. I know it's never really been resolved, but I'd hate to see that demand, which I consider to be legitimate demand, go unmet when it's there. But I don't know how you're going to resolve it. I guess I just bring it up for discussion, and we'll see how it works, I guess.
Well, in response, that is one of the most difficult aspects, defining non-conforming versus conforming. And I believe that with the experience that we've had operating the program for the last 3 years, I think with HFC that they seem to me willing to tackle that problem.
They don't seem like they've been willing in the past, but I don't know if that had to do with their... who was in charge there or what, but I got the impression that they weren't willing to take on the non-conforming before, but now maybe they are, I don't know. Hopefully.
I think that was true, and I think that we've had, in our discussions with HFC, have had excellent cooperation with them in trying to develop relationships between our two agencies to ensure that, one, our service areas and market areas are clearly defined and delineated, and two, that we cooperate and coordinate our efforts, and that we ensure that no Alaskan is without an opportunity to mortgage funds.
Thank you. Thank
you. Jeff, regarding the unrestricted mortgage loan interest payments and all other receipts, is they have taken that particular language out of this bill. To be consistent with AHFC, is I'd like you to draft some language that can go in the front section of the operating budget also to have the same effect, that they can keep the interest rate also with the non-conforming.
Okay.
Representative Rieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was one of the questions I was going to ask, is why that was removed. But I had another question having to do with on the non-conforming housing, whether loans can be made for houses which are sitting on lots which do not meet DEC, or if it's within a municipality, the municipal water and sewer regulations.
Yes, that loans have been made,
in those two situations before. My staff now in the housing division is working very closely with DEC to work in solving that problem, but there have been loans that have been made in those circumstances before, and we're trying to work out with DEC a way to avoid that in the future, because there are some environmental protections that should not be waived just because of the non-conforming nature. There's some health aspects of it that can affect other residents around that home and need to be taken into consideration.
Okay, there's a problem, at least in my district, that's occurred more than once, where we've had a situation where the lateral separation between a well and a septic tank used to be in conformance with the standards, and then the municipalities changed the standards, and now the houses are out of conformity and these people can't sell their homes. And I was advised that they could not go to the non-conforming housing loan program, even in that circumstance. I'd sure appreciate you looking into that if you're saying that that can be done. There's no new construction out of conformance, but these are where the rules of the game were switched to midstream on a homeowner who had a house which was built to code when it was first built, a lot built to code.
I will look into that.
Okay. Thank you. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions?
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I would move and ask unanimous consent that we pass out
Chairman,
the...
May I just comment on the legislation?
Sure.
Briefly. I'm Dick Schultz from the Tok area. 99% of the communities that are on that sheet of paper are the communities that are in my district that are now urban. I just want to comment on it. The letter of intent that took along here, I've gone over this with Senator Ferguson, and we're in agreement, and maybe we'll try to accomplish the loans through Alaska Housing. Doubts as to whether it will or not, because I believe that they'll tighten up the regulations as such that they'll eliminate a lot of these people. However, don't always believe the materials that you receive in your packet, because in going over these communities, Black Rapids is not a community, it's a lodge. Porter City is not a community, it's a lodge. In fact, Matt died here a couple of years ago. Brown Court is not a community. Cathedral Rapids is not a community. It's a bluff outside of Tok. And it's not Christ O'China, it's Chistochina. Christ. Gardner Creek Camp is exactly that. It's a maintenance camp. It's a state camp. It's not a community. Huffman's is not a community. Lignite is a creek. Rex is a bridge. Solana is a little white spot in the road. Sourdough is a lodge. Sportsman's is a lodge. Soslota is a lake. So this information that you get in your packet is not always and necessarily true, but there are communities that were eliminated from there. Chicken Eagle, Golcana, Glen Allen, Tana Cross, and the village of Eagle. So in defining rural, it's very difficult, and I know that these people have had some opportunities to fall into a loan program at one time and then turn around and fall out of a program at another. So I'm going to be working very, very hard this next, during the interim here, and trying to come up with a definition of the word rural that will be hopefully compatible to all the communities that are actually of rural status in the state of Alaska. So that's all I have.
Pat?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to be working hard with the loans chairman to make sure that we don't give loans to bridges and lakes. I think that's carrying our loan program too far.
Well,
I did have a serious question, actually.
Those people live in those areas, but they're associated, maybe Rex would be Anderson, more than likely.
On the letter of intent, the last paragraph on the finance letter of intent, finally, it's the intent of the House to help the department provide housing loans to farmers who possess patents for with agricultural covenants. What's the problem?
Well, the problem is the patent language that's been that the state issued to the farmers. The farmer would buy his agricultural, let's just say that he bid $1 million on the land and paid it off. If he took that patent language that the state gave him and went into the bank wouldn't honor it. Try to go to the state wouldn't even honor it. So finally, they, in fact, it was just here the other day that, that Jeff wrote this letter to us saying that, I don't have a copy of it, I guess, but saying that the patent language was now acceptable through community and regional affairs for the purposes of loans for building homes.
So you'd hope to transfer
the next day, legislation come along eliminating those people. You see? So one day they were in it, one and the next day. So it's taken about 3 or 4 years just to get the patent language to the point where it's acceptable for loans. Loan purposes and building homes. So hopefully, you know, Alaska Housing and Finance, with this letter of intent, will honor those ag right patents. So that's the intent.
Further questions? Thank you, Representative Schultz.
Okay.
Just for the information of the committee and the business about the interest, the loans committee elected to not have the interest automatically be appropriated back into the fund, and it brought to our attention that Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, each year in the budget, in the front page of the budget language, there's an appropriation that puts the interest back in. And if we were to change the statute, it was our feeling that that would mean it would be an automatic flow of the interest back into the revolving fund. And we elected to leave it as it is. And that would be that each year the legislature would be required to appropriate the interest. And I think that's happened this year. I think it's the exact amount of the interest that was generated by that account has been reappropriated back.
I have no problem with that. This is, I was going to put it in the language under unconforming and as section 15 in the front of this section, but I can't do it since we didn't pass that particular language. So I'm going to have to put it in 195, but I won't put it in today as this bill is completed. I'll do it on the Senate side to take care of that thing. So as long as it's understood here. Is there anything else on this particular bill?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Move and ask unanimous consent that we
accept the, go ahead.
We adopt the House, let's see, I guess a loan, the House CS for Senate Bill 65 loans. And move it to the committee with zero fiscal note.
Is there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. We also have two letter of intents.
Mr. Chairman, I would move and ask unanimous consent that we adopt and pass along both the Senate Finance Committee letter of intent as well as the House Finance Committee letter of intent.
Is there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. One of the last bills we forgot a letter of intent that went along with the pay raises, the House letter of intent.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if everybody has this or not.
Could you read it?
This letter of intent is, it is the intent of the legislature that negotiated salary schedules for employees covered by collective bargaining agreements and salary schedules for non-covered employees are approved and will be paid. For FY86, 80% of the general fund support requirements are funded. Funding requirements from other sources are fully funded. I would move and ask consent that we adopt this House Finance Committee letter of intent for Finance CS for HB 243.
Is there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. The next bill we'll take up is committee substitute for House Bill number 114, Transportation, an act relating to the transportation of heavy vehicles to provide an effective date. This particular bill will lose federal highway funds if this bill does not pass. Under the bill, the state must refuse to register trucks if the owner cannot prove that the federal heavy use taxes have been paid. There is a cost of $16,200 in order to notify vehicle owners of the change in law. At this time, I'm going to turn the chair over to Representative Ringstad. The Representative Duncan and Representative Ewling and I will be going down and starting the conference committee on the operating budget.
Is anyone here to testify on SB 114? Are there questions? Representative Porcheau?
I thought maybe Representative Samaski and Representative Frank would want to piggyback the truck safety bill on this.
Let's not give any ideas. They've got two vehicles now that they're fighting over. Any other comments or discussion
on this bill?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Rieger.
Just a quick question on the fiscal note, if I can. Is the the analysis of the fiscal note shows a 4 months for a position, a motor vehicle representative one. Is that a 4 months that will be continued into the following fiscal year as a full-time position, or is this a one-time, one-shot thing to have this position funded?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm Bill Brown, Division of Motor Vehicles. Basically, the intent is that it follows through from year to year. And the reason for that, the majority of these vehicles, we're speaking of vehicles of 55,000 pounds or more. Most of them do expire during the month of December, registered during the month of December. That position would be the one that would mail out this specific form advising them that their registration must be accompanied by the proof of payment of the federal tax. Any of them that expire some other time of the year, basically other than during that 4 month period, would be handled by existing staff.
Okay, so this position, you have it listed as a seasonal.
It is a 4 month seasonal position. Basically, we're looking at October through January.
Okay. I just wanted to get on record that you do not intend to roll that into a full time position the following year after.
No.
Okay, that's all I have, Mr. Chair.
Further questions? Thank you, sir. Motion to move out the
removed.
Is there any objection with the $16,000 fiscal note? No objections. We'll move 114 out. Okay. Next one we've got is SB 157. This continues the life of the Alaska Administrative Journal. Lieutenant Governor's office has requested $110,000 to fund this. The chair has prepared a fiscal note that would allow $45,000 in program receipts for the printing of this. Sally Hansen here. You want to testify on this or just answer questions?
I'd like questions? To ask a couple quick questions.
Could you come up to the table, please?
For the record, my name is Sally Hansen, Special Assistant to the Lieutenant Governor.
Sally, can you please give me a couple examples of tangible benefit that this journal has brought to state?
It makes available to the public activities that are normally found in newspaper advertising. Not necessarily in one newspaper, so it would eliminate an individual from having to subscribe to every newspaper in the state to find out what particular agency is putting out to bid or making notice of a public hearing. Those types of activities that state government does from day to day.
Has it saved us money?
Excuse me?
Has it saved the state money?
I think in the long run, it will save the state a lot of harassment out there in the general public, where we are normally criticized for not making those activities available as a general information.
Well, let me go.
We will eliminate a lot of criticism for not only the legislator, but the executive branch as well. 36 other states do publish the same type of information. Bulletin, register, journal, whatever they might call it.
How many subscribers do you have to it?
Approximately 200 at the moment.
200 subscribers. Mm-hmm. Well,
100%.
And the cost of it is?
$250 per subscription, only to cover the cost of printing and hard copy and postage.
Why don't we charge for the full cost of operation?
The fiscal note was based on 500 subscribers. At the moment, we're distributing 350, 200 of which are paid. If we can, eventually we feel that we can attract the 500, which will then be a return of $125,000. Right now, the administrative code has 1,300 subscribers. We feel that, given this program a good chance, we will attract a comparable number. Not only do we in the state use the code, but throughout the United States and foreign countries that are interested in what our state does use is the code. And this journal is going toward that general direction of being a usable document for everything state government does.
Representative Porchell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to take a little different tack here. I think we do a lot of things in the state, and we've passed a lot of legislation out of this committee that certainly doesn't pay for itself. I mean, that's kind of a contradiction in government. We're supposed to be providing services, and that's how we rationalize spending all this money. So I think the premise to start with is, does this provide a service that's worthwhile, because it's worth, in essence, subsidizing, even though the cost is fairly modest? And I'm convinced it does. I have one question on the fiscal note, and that's in the original fiscal note, we showed both revenues from sales as well as the costs. And then in the new fiscal note, we just show a $45,000 operating cost. And I'm assuming we're still going to have revenues, and that you would, it's your intent still to boost up subscriptions and to try to increase revenues. And I guess I'd.
We're going to fall a little short of advertising. Out of the Senate State Affairs Committee, a substitute was offered to allow us to publish weekly, thereby provide more timely information contained in the journal. To stay within the FY appropriation for FY86, we eliminated or deleted those dollars that we would have used for advertising purposes, and we'll try to devise another method of getting that information out, that the journal is available and try to keep the cost within a reasonable amount of money.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just to ask the question another way then, you've seen the new fiscal note, right?
I was informed of it yesterday.
Do you feel that you can do an adequate job with this fiscal?
No, sir, I don't.
What would be the sacrifice, or what would be the cutbacks that would be necessary with this fiscal note?
We'd be falling short of the dollars necessary to provide those copies or issues that we are now providing, which is 350. The dollar figure to provide 350 users 52 times a year will cost $57,774.26, according to your legislative print shop, who gave me that figure. The postage then would run approximately around $15,000. The reason for first-class postage is to get this in from this journal to the user in a timely manner. We enter the information into ATMS on approximately midday on a Thursday. We receive it all on Wednesday. Legislative Affairs print shop prints for us, and we have it on Friday, and it's in the mail Friday afternoon, first class. So we feel that we have to stay with the first class postage. We'll run about that month. It allows no, that figure comes to 72,000 approximately. It allows then us no growth as far as increasing our subscription. However, we feel we could still do an adequate job to supply those users that we have now and devise some kind of method to do some advertising without cost, if you will, hopefully.
Of the current years, how much of the money was appropriated for FY85, how much of that is being lapsed back?
We decided to curtail our big advertising pending this legislation. We dealt with a lot of unknowns when we devised the first fiscal note. As we stand right now, we will lapse approximately $62,000 because we did curtail, as I mentioned, because of the pending legislation, we tried to be fiscally responsible with the job and come down to a true cost of what we were actually spending.
Representative Zemanski?
Is there any limitation on what you can charge for the journal?
No, there's not.
So
we devised that figure to make the first fiscal note was based on 1,000 users. So we broke it back down and set the charge at $250 to pay, come up to pay for that, the dollar that we were using or received in the appropriation.
Do you have a breakdown of the subscribers?
I do. As to who the subscribers are?
Uh-huh.
Well, I can tell you that we have several local governments. We have law libraries, we have Library of Congress, attorney firms from the lower 48. We have state agencies and several oil companies, Marathon, Chevron, Arco, Atlantic Richfield, Saro Marathon. Individual consultant.
Yeah, I'm trying to get a handle
firms
on it. Is it the public that is subscribers to the journal, or is it businesses, corporations, like you say? How many public subscribers do you have? Let me try that one.
How do you go with it?
Non-governmental.
Non-government. I'd say at least 50% of what we have are just basic individuals, that small refrigeration folks, just, and state agencies, of course.
I appreciate getting a copy of that subscription list.
I can have that available to you.
Further questions? Thanks, ma'am.
Thank you.
In preparing this, the new fiscal note, Representative Adams has gone through and cut that one back to $45,000 and has gone through and discussed that with Lieutenant Governor, so they are aware of that. Apparently willing to accept that. What's the pleasure of the committee on 157? Senator Porcello?
I'm going to make the motion. Are they going to be able to do the job? I mean, I guess that's what I want to be assured in, that we're not
really... Well, the understanding I have is that Lieutenant Governor discussed this with Representative Adams and was willing to buy off on it.
Mr. Chairman, I would move and ask unanimous consent that we pass out CS for Senate Bill 157, State Affairs, with the accompanying fiscal note.
Which
fiscal note? With individual recommendations.
With the $45,000 fiscal note?
Yes.
Any objections? Hearing none. So ordered. Next one we'll take up is SB 169. This bill gives the court ordered restitution priority over debts owed to the state or others when a person's permanent fund dividend is levied, attached, earned, etc. Child support payments remain as the first priority. It's got a zero fiscal note on it. Is there someone here from revenue? Okay. Questions to the sponsor's office first?
Yeah.
Before we get to revenue?
Guy, it seems like there was one. We had a bill in here last year. In fact, I think Bob Bettis were sponsored one, something like this. I don't know if it died in the Senate or what happened. Are you aware of that?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Guy Van Dorn, for the record. I heard about it. It's a little bit different than this. Basically, all this bill does is that instead of allowing the court-ordered restitution, instead of allowing them to take 50% of a person's permanent fund dividend, they can take 100% in court-ordered restitution. I think there's a letter to the senator in your packet. It's one of the reasons why we introduced this. And it placed it, we made a prioritizing so that child support is first priority. This court-ordered restitution is the second priority. Debts to the state is the third priority. They wanted to prioritize it, but to make sure the child support was taken care of.
I see. Last year they had a $40,000 positive fiscal note on this, on that bill last year, because they were going to be able to collect more from past due taxes, but I guess they're not going to collect any more this year.
All we're doing is changing. We're only adding the part in as far as court order restitution. That's all we're changing the bill to read.
I see. Okay, thanks.
Further questions, Mr. asking?
Well, maybe it's not hard to speak to the sponsor, but why have an exemption at all for permanent fund? I was, why not make it 100% available?
Pardon me?
Why not make 100% of available instead of just 50%?
That's what this does, Representative Samaski. It makes 100% available for court-ordered restitution. Currently, it's only 50%.
But it's only for court-ordered restitution. Well, in other words, I'm curious, does anybody know why we ever...
I think it was the idea that we didn't want people that had outstanding credit obligations to lose their permanent fund dividend. It was a... I don't know exactly why, but...
Protecting the giveaway.
Yeah, right. They didn't think that creditors should be benefiting from the Alaska Permanent Fund dividend.
Senator Breaker?
I was going to say, I've never really been comfortable with the exemption of the 50% for anything either. I think this is a step in the right direction, but I wouldn't mind seeing it go farther. And You know, income is income, and if there's legitimate reasons for garnishing income, I can't see why the permanent fund should be treated differently. But this bill is a step in the right direction. It doesn't do a lot, but I think there's no reason not to oppose this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do we have questions of the department? Do you want to testify or just to answer questions?
I'm just here to answer questions.
Questions?
No, no questions. I was going to make a motion. Ready for a motion?
Yes. Representative Frank?
I would make a motion that we pass out the committee substitute for Senate Bill 169.
Any objections? Hearing none. Ordered. Okay. SB 300. This bill authorizes the governor to spend more than $1 million from the disaster release fund to take care of floods that may occur this year. Reason that the bill authorizes the funding in advance is so that a special session will not be needed in case the flooding that is predicted takes place. We've got someone here to answer questions if we have any.
Yes, sir. I'd like to ask.
Okay. Mr. Roundtree, you want to join us, please?
For the record, I'm Dick Roundtree, legislative liaison for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, and the Alaska Division of Emergency Services, one of our divisions, which handles flood control and disaster, stuff like that.
Well, let me ask you a question on this. I was under the impression that the legislature's not in session. There's an emergency. The governor has the ability to tap the emergency relief fund, but is that not correct?
I think what this bill really does is give the governor the power to declare an emergency, which amounts to over $1 million, without legislative action at this time.
The way it reads now is he can tap the fund up to $1 million,
yes,
without,
sir,
legislative approval.
That's right.
Well, what's his current limitation?
$1 million per disaster, he said.
So he could tap up to $1 million for that disaster without us being around, right?
Right, yes.
And what's this bill give him?
I'm understanding this bill gives authority to declare a disaster for over $1 million. In the interim, until the legislature meets next.
Up to $300 million. $297. We can take the whole rainy day account.
Mm-hmm. Is there a reason, do you know, why it was just left open this way?
I believe the reason for this bill is to the impending high flood threat we have this year.
But is there, have you heard of any woman? Obviously, even with a flood threat, you know it's only going to spend a certain amount of money. It obviously isn't going to spend the full $300 million in rainy day account. Is there a top limit that's been discussed? I mean, what
reasonably can we expect to see from this?
We never project
what a flood's going to cost you, but with a bad breakup and flooding, what dollar-wise could we look at? $2 million, $10 million, $50
million? Well, it's considered opinion of the department that we have enough money in the disaster relief fund right now to take care of a moderate case circumstance. Maybe not a worst case, but we expect that there is enough in the disaster relief fund now to take care of any emergencies this year. However, some of those emergencies could run over $1 million on a worst-case circumstance.
Well, this isn't the first time we've had flooding, so...
No, it isn't. This is the first time that we've had such a forecast of breakup in many, many years.
What's the worst possible case scenario that you've had in the past? I mean, if you take that and then doubled it, what would it be?
Well, I've been with the department about... 9 or 10 years now, and I've seen disasters that can go up to $1.5 million.
$1.5 million?
Yes, sir. We often don't get one that runs more than that, unless it is a major disaster, say a 6th earthquake, something like that.
Why don't we just put a limit of 1.5 million?
Representative Porcello?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm too concerned with the upward limit, and I'm wondering if we even need to make a dollar amount so much as we've gone through such agony on the rainy day account that I would be satisfied even with limiting the total expenditure, the total authorization, to not exceed the balance of the emergency account of the disaster relief fund. I mean, I think that's probably the starting point, and maybe we might want to work down from there. But I'm real uncomfortable with giving the governor the authority to dip into the rainy day account.
Well, that's probably reasonable, huh? Not to exceed. Jack, quick one there, fast pin.
What was the figure you were thinking of?
If the highest we've had yet has been 1.5 million, I think the Massey's that you can go over that some, but obviously 300 is a little high.
I don't know if Mr. Frank was going to ask, but he raised a question here that I didn't know the answer to. What can they spend this money on? Can the governor, for instance, declare an emergency if an entire town has to get floated down the river and build everybody a new house? Or?
No, that's not
that
right.
Sounds like, I realize that's probably a ridiculous example, but right. I'm trying to see how, trying to get an idea of how far a person could go.
We have a disaster plan, and for instance, the Southeast disaster we had very recently here, what happens there is Small Business Administration gets involved in quite a few number of loan programs, and we certainly don't put everything back exactly like it was. We go in and relieve the impending loss of life and property, and then the people go through the hoops of determining what type of loan programs that are available to them, what types can they afford, or if they can't afford, they fall into another category. But it is strictly not a 100% grant process to take care of things.
Maybe you could give us, maybe you already did this and I wasn't listening closely enough, but maybe you could give us an example of a hypothetical river village that would be affected by flooding, and then what would the Department of Military Affairs do, or how would the disaster relief fund be expended in a typical case?
Okay, I think first of all they would survey the extent of a disaster, and it would be determined if the people could actually take care of the loss themselves to start with. Say that it was not possible, then a disaster is declared, and an awful lot of the money just goes for aid to the municipality to get the utilities and power, stuff like that, going again. Where it gets down to the individual aid, you get into a situation there where if people have insurance, we don't take care of that. Or if people can qualify for, say, a type of low interest a loan program, we don't get involved in that. It gets down to an area where if you've got an example, take an old person that's 75 years old, is on pension, Social Security, therefore we may go ahead and replace the person's roof on their house. So it's quite a complex plan, and people do have to qualify. We use the federal criteria for an awful lot of aid that we give, and we just don't go in and replace everything the person had. There's no winners in a disaster.
Further questions? Ms. Maskey?
Well, it's really almost impossible for you to exceed the $5 million 800 balance, isn't it? I mean, I can't imagine it has to be a real catastrophe.
Well.
You haven't got any other big ones coming up that you don't know about, huh?
Well, unfortunately, we can't predict those, but there is a high to moderate flood damage on the Susitna, the Kuskokwim, quite a few places on the Yukon. I understand the Tanana now has gone down to moderate to low. So things are, so far, we're sort of holding our breath. Things are working out fairly well, I'm told, as far as not getting all of a sudden 65 degrees and all that snow starts melting at one time. So we can't predict disasters, but on the other hand, if it did turn into the worst case scenario, maybe it would circumvent a special session if the limit was raised.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think we're going to have summer this year.
Mr. Chairman?
President Cobb.
Is Max Gifford going to testify? Because I think that, I'd like to ask.
Have him come up and ask.
Yeah, I'd like, I got to
ask questions. I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Mr. Gifford.
Yeah, Mr. Gifford, you probably heard the discussion here about whether or not we ought to put an upper limit on this, and I assume that that discussion's taken place before, and I just wonder what your observations were on that subject.
Actually, just for the record, Max Gifford, with Senator Sackett's office, I'd not heard a limitation discussed before through any of the committees that it went through that I was at. If the members feel that they want to put a limitation on it just to feel more comfortable, I certainly suppose you can do that. The whole thrust of the bill was to make sure that we had something in place for the governor to respond to once and if an emergency was declared, because we presume the legislature would be out of session and he cannot exceed expenditure of $1 million without legislative authorization. So we thought, let's get this in place in the event that the flooding that is expected comes about.
I think it's a great idea to plan ahead about avoiding a special session. So I commend you for that. I don't know enough about the history of river flooding and the amount of damage that might occur in the worst of years to know how much of a limit to put on it. And on the other hand, like if it was really that tremendous, and perhaps there should be a special session, I suppose. But
there has been quite a bit of talk about unusually high flood potential this year as opposed to years past. I know over the years that we have occasionally had to do this type of authorization for specific flooding sites along the Yukon or Kuskokwim and other areas in the state. Usually it's affected maybe one or two communities. There's been a lot of discussion about more than one or two communities being involved this year, but I'm certainly not qualified to predict, you know, who's going to get hit. I do know that their water levels in some areas are getting pretty high, even though the ice hasn't broke yet.
Overflow. Thank you.
Senator Frank?
Thank you. Max, is a flood in one area and a flood in another area on the same river considered the same disaster and would be subject to the $1 million limitation?
I don't know.
Maybe Mr. Roundtree could answer that.
Roundtree?
Yes, we generally declare a disaster for a certain...
Max, why don't you hang in? I think we've got more questions for you, too. Go ahead, Mr. Roundtree.
Past history, we have declared a disaster for usually individual villages if they're, you know, far enough apart, it seems like now. For instance, Southeast disaster did include more than one town because it was a generalized storm that caused it all. But past history, as we've declared disasters as the flood does hit the different villages, like on the Yukon, it does happen.
So, with the Yukon flooding, could the governor take up to $1 million for each village that was declared a disaster?
To my understanding, if we do it the way that has been done in the past, that could happen, yes.
Which would alleviate some of the problem for the cap.
Yes, it would.
Okay. Representative Frank, further questions? Representative Rieger, questions of...
Question for Mr. Gifford, if he's still here. I just wondered if you had a dollar figure in mind, back to the talk about the special session, figure in mind beyond which you thought a special session would be preferable to giving the discretion to the governor?
No.
You don't have a recommendation? Okay. That was my only question.
No other questions? Mr. Porcello?
Max, just in the interest to try to address this, and there may be other ideas, but what would your response be to a new section or another section which would say something like, under the authority given by Section 1 of this Act, the governor may not spend more than the assets of the Disaster Relief Fund? This would be one approach. Another approach would be just to choose an arbitrary dollar figure like $3 million, $4 million, $5 million.
What are the assets of the fund right now?
$5.8 million
or something.
All right, was explained to me. I think there's a memo that was addressed to Representative Clarkson. As it was explained to me earlier this week, at the agency level, they have $1,125,000, and then if they need to tap into more in the fund itself, there was some $5,800,000 or something.
Right. So that would be the figure that you'd be referring to, Mr. Pichot?
Well, we also have passed some legislation. I think Author Haynes, I think we've taken out $1.6 million, or we don't know what it is. So
whatever that balance is,
less than 5.8 in by the time these other things catch up. So I don't know if the 5.8 reflects a 1.6 expenditure in Haynes or not, but. Or Anchorage, I think the governor took out $400,000 or $300,000 for stream pollution.
Representative Rieger?
Just a question on the assets of the Disaster Relief Fund. Isn't it the case that $5 million will be transferred into it once a year so that there will be $10 million in the fund?
The statute actually reads that we will refund the Disaster Relief Fund up to $5 million on the 1st of July of each year. Due to past practices, we had requested the $5 million on an annual basis. We ended up with an excess in that fund due to our not knowing exactly what could happen. And that's why it is over $5 million at this time. We did not request